So, okay, why don't you start off by telling me your name and where you're from and who you're representing and why you're here?
My name is Christy Anomis, and I'm Plains Cree Salto of the George Gordon First Nation in Saskatchewan, Canada. I grew up in Winnipeg, Canada, which is a very Indigenous city, and I've been living in Iowa City for 14 years. I have my master's degree here from the University of Iowa in Religious Studies with a focus on Native American studies. I founded Indigenous Iowa a few years ago, and also the Little Creek Camp, which was a resistance camp to the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I work right now for the best organization in the world, Seeding Sovereignty, which is an Indigenous women's led organization. And you know, based upon dismantling colonial institutions and rebuilding with Indigenous ideologies that are in synchronicity with the land. And my title with that organization is Decolonizer, self-proclaimed. And I direct two programs, our SHIFT program, which stands for Seeding the Hill with Indigenous Freethinkers, and our Land Resilience program.
Okay, thank you. So I think I'm going to just jump straight in with the final word that you had on that panel conversation, which was this debate that that opened up around climate strikes and social movements that have appeared just recently, and the ways in which they continue to reproduce white supremacist thought and imperialism in ways that might, well, in fact, I think, in your words, was potentially looking in the wrong direction. And you said that you had a lot more theory or a lot more to say about that, so I just thought I could just take this opportunity to ask you what some of those thoughts were.
So it's not to disparage what's happening
Yeah.
because, of course, it's good, okay? We want awareness. We have to try and start convincing those that don't think climate change is happening, you know, to come to our side, right? We do want to ignite and awaken, you know, the middle upper class who's living, you know, fat off the land and not necessarily wanting to, you know, do anything because they're really comfortable, right? We do want a worldwide movement. We do want youth to speak up. So it's not like these are bad things, okay?
Yeah.
But what's unfortunate about it is it sort of seems like the only thing that gets this amount of attention. And I don't think that that's okay because it's not that these aren't great events and or movements, but they don't provide actual answers. You know, it's more about holding a sign, shaking your fist, and then going home. The continued support for some of these marches and actions doesn't necessarily keep going in the long run. We've seen a lot of these things come and go. You know, the Women's March, many of the climate marches that have happened around the nation now for quite a few years, and then again now this new thing, the climate strikes. And so what, you know, most likely will happen is, you know, it will continue to, you know, build support and recognition for a period of time. But if like true action isn't taken because of these, you know, these strikes, then it's not going to actually make real change. I think that people could have been making real change and we wouldn't be facing this climate crisis that we're facing right now if they listened to what Indigenous people had been saying, you know, at the very beginning of the settler invasion of this country and this continent and frankly the whole entire world. You know, people have our ancestors, you know, there's warnings that have been written down where, you know, they said things like you can't, you know, clear cut that entire forest. You can't chop off that entire mountain. You can't monocrop that entire, you know, state. You know, there's been warnings and there's been answers that have been offered, but, you know, largely ignored. And that's what I see happening right now as well. I think that instead of funneling so much time, money, and attention into what I call like high energy and high workload versus, you know, the actual like output that is created from it, which is minimal, I think we need to start investing into, you know, answers. So you know, these are frankly even answers that don't take a lot of energy and don't take a lot of time to come to a really great a really great ending, because there's already people on the ground doing it. So Indigenous peoples are already, you know, already doing green jobs. They are already, you know, practicing a lot of these agricultural practices that CSAs and organic farms are picking up now. Indigenous peoples have answers to a lot of what's going on. And I feel like if we're to funnel our money and our time and our energy into what these people are doing and saying, we could actually curtail the worst effects of climate change. But it's not happening because there's still a white supremacist mentality that is running rampant through, you know, the environment and climate change movements that people themselves don't even recognize. Because why, let me ask this, why would it, you know, and this is not to disparage Greta Thunberg, because I think she's fantastic. I think all of these, you know, people doing this work are fantastic. But why would this particular person be getting this much attention when, you know, there are children and young adults and, you know, whatever, up to elders, like in our own backyards, that have been doing this work, that have died at the front lines, that are like doing, like have actual answers to these problems? Why would they not be getting the same attention? And why haven't they? We all know the answer. It's because white people still don't trust what brown people have to say. You know, and in the end, people still want a white savior. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate, because I think that what Greta Thunberg is doing is amazing. And it should be met with a lot of applause. But it shouldn't be drowning out, for instance, what happened to the Indigenous youth at the last UN climate summit that just happened, like, recently, where the Indigenous youth session was sparsely attended. I mean, let's be honest. Why do you think it was sparsely attended, right? I mean, it was sparsely attended because all of the attention was being put forth to, you know, this person, this wonderful person, mind you, but to Greta Thunberg. And it's just really sad because we know that racism is alive and well in this country. We know institutionalized racism is alive and well. And we know that white supremacy is a type of thinking that even the environmental and climate change movements still have running through their veins. The one thing I think that it's important to note about all of this is we think of climate change as, or I do anyway, as this ethereal thing, as something happening in the air because it's about gases getting into the, you know, atmosphere and changing the climate and causing, you know, disrupting weather patterns and causing severe weather, so on and so forth. And then in the end, you know, we're going to bake, right? But it's not really about that. It's about, like, our relationship to the land. It's how we treat our environment and the spaces that we live in that is causing climate change. So with that being said, no other person or no other groups of people on this planet have more to say about that than Indigenous peoples, who right now are safeguarding 80% of the world's biodiversity through literally their lives. You know, they are saving, they are protecting, and they are tenaciously continuing ways to support, you know, ways of being that with their lives. And the fact that this isn't made more prominent within the climate movement is really disturbing to me.
Okay, thank you for also repeating some of the things that was mm-hmm. really helpful. I have so many questions for you, and I don't want to blast you with them all because you've just come off the panel and you being...
It's okay.
And I could talk about this. I've got so many questions that have been building up. But I'm going to just go in at this part, which is that we've heard... So Jackie says some really interesting things about an anecdote she shared from the Pacific Northwest where a lady said, we have been trying to teach the visitors for 500 years, and how long will we be asked to continue to teach them? And we've heard a lot as well from you about, and others, about the answers being rooted in indigenous relationships to land and practices and knowledges and so on. And I was just, in terms of thinking about that tension, if that is a tension point, is it a tension point to you? How would something like a mass movement around a climate discourse start talking about the things that you're talking about? And
it's really easy. Yeah. Everything comes down to money. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the truth of it. The reason why a lot of our work doesn't gain traction is simply because we don't have the means to keep things, you know, going in terms of movements, you know, like Standing Rock, for instance. Or we don't get we don't run in the same circles that a lot of these climate movement people run in. In the end, like, I'm just gonna straight up say, like, funding, and I mean massive amounts of funding, need to, like, just start going to indigenous communities, nations, and organizations doing this work. And the millions of dollars going to Extinction Rebellion right now, the millions of dollars going to the climate strikes, the millions of dollars going to the Sierra Club and to Greenpeace and to, you know, the 20 organizations, climate organizations that get the bulk of foundation funding each year in this country, I think the majority of that should just go directly to indigenous peoples. That's it. It's really simple. They don't trust us, though. Like, they don't, they would never do that, because it's almost like, to them, it's like they can't imagine giving that amount of money to, you know, Native people. You know, they talk about social impact investing all the time. They talk about new ways of investing their money. It's being socially and environmentally responsible. And yet I've spoken to groups of these really rich investors in these, like, really fancy spaces, and said things like, Indigenous women are the walking embodiment of a social impact strategy. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I get a lot of blank looks. They don't understand that, like, through colonization and genocide, we've managed to keep our cultures going. We've managed to raise our children through, you know, the heteropatriarchy. And yet we have, you know, the highest rate of missing and murdered women in this country right now as we speak. But here we are still doing this work because we're badasses. And if we were to be given millions of dollars to do this work, we would, you know, we would move mountains. For real, we would. We would literally change the world if given that chance. People just don't see it, and they don't trust us. They still think we're incompetent. They think we're inept. I think, in fact, you know, a lot of white supremacists, you know, think we're lesser than them, that we're not as human as them.
Okay, thank you. That's really a black and white answer to that question. I have another question, which is about, I didn't know if you were familiar with the broader context of these events, which is the program called the Mississippi - an Anthropocene River.
Yes.
And so we are having some conversations. So I'm staying with a river semester group at the moment that are canoeing down the river Mississippi, and together we're all having conversations around thinking about what that means for the whole program to exist, what the word Anthropocene means, how that gets translated or operationalized in different ways. I've thought a little bit about the idea of abstraction. I've talked to other people about the problem of abstraction, and I think AJ said it as well. He's like, he said this amazing thing, which is when he was at the climate marches, that, you know, he was told that we've had a land acknowledgement, we respect indigenous people, but just not you. And so I'm some of the problematics around abstraction, around Anthropocene, around what it means for this program or these, your work and other people's work here to be translated into cultural production in Europe, and mm-hmm. just what all this means to be together in this space right now, I guess. That's tons of questions in one, but anything that you've...
Okay, can you just give me a specific question? Sorry.
Okay, so let's think about the word Anthropocene.
Okay.
What does the word Anthropocene mean to you?
I don't know, to be honest. Anthropocene, anthropological, and I'm guessing it's just an anthropological... viewpoint.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a term that's obviously being used in lots of different contexts. It's
yes.
a very contested term. What people sometimes like, well, what they say it means is that it denotes a new geological era, one that has been so deeply...
Oh, Anthropocene. Humanity. Yes. Yeah.
Humanity.
Yes.
Yeah. So that,
okay.
So it's just coming up, and it can mean lots of different things to different people. So I'm just trying to get a sense of if it means anything to you, or if it brings up anything in particular, or...
I can't talk about that necessarily because I don't think I've read enough of the literature surrounding Anthropocene. Mm-hmm. And it would mean a new geological era. Okay. So, I know what Anthropocene, so I actually did a year of geology, so I don't know why I forgot that. I've just never really heard it used in a climate context, I guess. What are you guys using it as?
Well, I mean, I'm not using it in any particular way. I'm holding it up.
But yeah.
The project, Mississippi and Anthropocene River, is that it was of interest to people working in the humanities and the social sciences because it was coined by earth science.
Yeah.
And it was a moment where earth scientists said, hey, look, it was human actions and it was society and it was our economic systems all along. Like, in fact, we need to address those things mm-hmm. if we're going to really address what's going on with mm-hmm. the changes of earth science.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways people see it as this fantastic opening because it starts to move beyond this binary of nature and culture, which is obviously, you know, Western Enlightenment thinking
mm-hmm.
and everything that we see before us is kind of predicated upon. So lots of people think it's really has loads of opportunities. Other people see it as attributing responsibility to all humans, when of course it's only a minority of people that have really perpetuated the systems that have changed the earth so dramatically, and that it kind of abstracts from very specific places. I mean, I think that's why this program is here, because they're interested in what does it mean to look at a geographic process or entity or region or space like the Mississippi River and all of the mm-hmm. processes that are going through that, and how can we understand these issues through this specific context. So, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I think it's great when people try to understand things through different terminologies. I'm always, you know, wary of, you know, how science likes to categorize things, though, because it usually completely discounts, you know, what Native people have to say. Or it likes to think that it's doing something new and take credit for it, when essentially Native people have been doing these things for a very long time. So I guess that would be my answer to, you know, terminologies that are, you know, buzzwords and or you know, new scientific ways of thinking, as we always have to remember that, you know, there's probably an indigenous, you know, group or, you know, a group of peoples that may or may not have already been doing this. So
yeah. Okay, thank you. And so you talked a little, the other thing that I've been thinking about and I wanted to ask you about, which is this idea of pragmatism, or using the master's tools, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
Oh,
what
yeah,
I mean?
I know. But,
and you
yeah.
talked a lot about the paradox that you face with trying to participate in national scale political processes,
mm-hmm.
even though you despise everything that they represent. and we've encountered lots of those situations with some of the programming over the past 5 days, which is like needing to use these institutional mechanisms and processes in order to mm-hmm. have political recognition and rights, but at the same time, fundamentally, you know, despising them or just trying to disavow them at the same time. And I wondered if you could, if you have any thoughts about that, or you could share with me any of your ideas about what that means.
And yeah, I mean, until the revolution, we need to keep chipping away at these, imperialist systems that have been, enforced and put upon us. I like to imagine, the United States boundaries of all the states and the boundaries between Canada and the U.S. and the boundary or the borders between, Mexico and the U.S. is like this rubber stamp that was just like placed upon us and cut us all off from our nationhoods and our, traditional migration routes and even just our simple ways of living our lives, food sources and so on and so forth. And so, I do despise this system. I mean, how could I not? It's responsible for the death of millions, billions around the world. And not just, in a passive way, in a very violent, direct attack is horrifying. It's a horrifying story. I mean, the things that were done to my people, my ancestors, and that are being done till this day is horrifying. And this system, this political system, has a lot to do with it. Absolutely. The Second Amendment, for instance, is a joke. The Second Amendment was made apparently to, do you want to close that door?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just,
yeah. I mean, the microphones are really good. They do pick up from that.
Yeah.
Where did you start from the Second Amendment?
The Second Amendment, for instance, to me, is a bit of a joke. It's supposedly instituted because, people needed a right to protect themselves from any further invasion, after, they freed themselves from the British, and also just to protect land, life, and liberty, from however they were trying to, build this nation. But really, it was about perpetuating a culture, a way of life, a thinking of settler vigilante ideologies that took over this continent. This continent, or this country, and as well as Canada, was built at the point of a gun, and that's why the gun is such an important part of this culture, because it provided these settler vigilantes with free labor, free land, and free resources. The ability to take anything they wanted, even women's bodies, and children, and so and then to reshape everything in their image. That's what boarding schools did. That's what, kill the Indian, save the man, that terminology, that's where that comes from. Or the doctrine of discovery or manifest destiny. I don't like any of this, but I was born into it, and I don't see us having the ability to necessarily take it out right now. We don't have that power. I mean, who's going to go up against the U.S. government? Who's going to try and change that system? Who has the ability to do that? We don't have the ability necessarily, to do that by standing up, and saying no, you cannot come onto our territory. And we've tried that. Look at Standing Rock. Look at Alcatraz. Look at Oka. Look at the Walleye Wars. I mean, we do and we don't. We can on small scale, but large scale is what I'm talking about. But we can infiltrate their system, and we can change it from the inside out. So we can indigenize Congress, and we can indigenize all these institutions. We can indigenize the academic system. We can indigenize Wall Street. We can bring about an indigenous-led regenerative economy through convincing these people all over the world how to invest their money, where they should put it. So, I mean, that's just the way I look at it right now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess using the master's tools. I don't really like that term, though, because, I think it diminishes, who we are. These are not our masters. You know, these are orphans that have no culture, that came from a place where there was already so much going on that was terrifying and horrible, that fled here and then brought all that disease and mental illness with them, and still haven't found a culture where they belong that can provide them with a sense of well-being and connection. Because what is American culture?
Yeah, I mean, it's capitalist, individual.
Colonial capitalism is American culture, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think colonial capitalism is officially a culture.
Yeah. Okay, and I agree with you as well about the master's tools. It's, the terminology is the same as well. I've heard about thinking about indigenization as opposed to decolonization, because rather than centering all the time the colonizer, thinking about what it means to indigenize,
mm-hmm.
the terminology is so important. I mean, that's quite a lot. That's really, really load of full answers.
Sorry.
No, that's...
I'm an academic, so I never just like...
No, it's really powerful. That's really amazing. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For talking to me. I mean, I think we'll leave it there for now. But yeah,
awesome.
I'm really grateful.
Yeah, you can...